Hello, welcome to Creativity, Hustlers, Fakers, and Thieves. I am so pleased to have Deb Stoner as my guest today. Thank you. Hi, Deb. How are you?
Hi, Gary. I'm good. Thanks.
I'm going to give a brief biography of you, and I'm certain to leave many things out because you're so prolific. So I met you as a metalsmith at the Oregon School of Arts and Crafts. And you were a metalsmith and teacher there. Then you became an eyewear designer. Yeah. And after some period of time, moved on to large-scale scanner photography. Is that the best way to describe it?
Oh, it's
a good describe it.
Describe it because it's accurate. It's photography that's created with the use of a scanner. So, and it's big. So it's large-scale. So, yeah.
Do you miss being a metalsmith?
Well, I'm still a metalsmith. Last night, my husband said, we need this little doohickey that goes like this in sort of a figure eight. And it needs to be about an inch long and it has to have two holes in it. Uh-huh. And so I sorted through my drawers of wire and this and that and was able in about 10 minutes to say, is it like this that you need? And he said, no. Anyway, we were onto the track of the next thing, and that's how that goes. So do I miss being a metalsmith? What I miss mostly about being a metalsmith is I miss working with my hands on a daily basis.
Right.
So my hands get a workout by doing things like, you know, an hour ago, I cracked a crab and pulled all the meat out of those parts that they have. I end up doing stuff like that on a more frequent basis than I do the craft that I'm best known for, which is metalsmithing. And that sort of daily interaction with the use of working with my hands, I miss that a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. Is it curiosity that moved you to different fields? Why did you take up eyewear design? I mean, was it metalsmithing? Were you still working in metal?
I was training as a jeweler. Well, at first I went to school as a geologist. I went to UC Davis and I got a degree in geology. And that was really hard. That was using my brain in a way that didn't come really natural to me. And the thing that came natural to me was working with my hands and being really interested in jewelry making. I'd gone to a high school in California that had a great jewelry metalsmithing program. And I was able to do that every day for 4 years of high school. And if that's not an inspiring thing for a kid to do, I don't know what is.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. But my parents, you know, pragmatic people who, you know, I grew up in a family who nobody had ever gone to college before. And here I was in the world where it seemed like maybe I could get a college degree. And so they encouraged me to do that. And my dad was a scientist, so maybe science would be the thing that I would want to do too. You know, and my parents meant well, but they didn't take into consideration the obvious thing that I really love to do, which was making jewelry. Uh-huh. So I went ahead and I got the degree. I lasted as a geologist for about a year. I ended up on the North Slope of Alaska. You know, in the late 70s, that's the job you get unless you go to graduate school and you start work on a master's degree, which I had no desire for. I just wanted to learn more about making jewelry. And so I ended up talking myself into a sort of an apprenticeship with a jeweler in Davis, California. I got to work with my hands. I got to learn a lot of techniques. And I thought that that was what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And, you know, these things happen. I had gone to a workshop in San Diego where I was studying for 2 weeks with Erlene Fish and Paul DeRay, a jeweler from Amsterdam, and watching the world of craft open up before my eyes was something really profound. And Arlene encouraged me to apply and go to graduate school. And so I did. I had just a very different experience than most people in a craft program. because I didn't have art history background. I didn't have all the things that I was going to be asked to take as a student in an MFA program, but I had pretty good mastery over the craft of metalsmithing because of the daily work as a jeweler. And that daily work was something that I just thrived on. I really loved it. I love the problem solving of repairing jewelry. Somebody would come into the store with something that meant everything to them. You know, jewelry is an extremely emotional art form and it would need to be fixed. I worked side by side a couple of people who really knew how to do all this stuff. And that working with a master right next to me, how do I do this? How do I not screw this up? That's, you know, the first sort of thing you try to learn as a metalsmith. And then going into graduate school, where everybody was just like, any kind of idea is a good one and worth exploring. It was just a whole different approach, but it was a good one because I could now use my imagination and then have a background of making that would tell me, this is how you might think about doing this. And so that was cool. When I was in graduate school, there was a particularly interesting fellow who taught in the photography program. And I thought, this looks good. I want to learn more about photography. I knew enough about photography in those days to be able to photograph my own jewelry work. But I didn't know really anything about the field of photography. And so I ended up studying photography sort of side by side with metalsmithing. There was always this sort of, which one am I more interested in at any given moment? And at different times in my life, for some reason or another, the other took hold. When I was in graduate school, this is getting to your question about how did I learn to make eyeglasses. When I was in graduate school, one of the things I learned about teachers in graduate school is that they often would assign things based on what they were curious about. And my teacher, Arlene Fish, had this curiosity about what would a group of graduate students do if given the concept of working with the concept of eyewear. It didn't have to be eyewear because there were some metalsmiths who worked quite large and in a non-functioning way, but that was the jumping off point for the assignment. And so that was something that when I had the assignment as a graduate student, I didn't do very well, but it was because I wasn't curious enough. I was actually kind of bugged about this assignment. It was something that I wasn't personally interested in at all. And so being, you know, asked to investigate this problem was one where I thought, it's not my thing. So I'll just do enough to get through this assignment. But one of the people we were studying with was curious in a way that has become something that I've never forgotten. This woman, her name was Gail Spence, and she was an American who left the United States in sort of her early 20s, and she went to Denmark to become a jeweler, and she became a very good jeweler and a very good designer. And probably in her 40s, she met Arlene Fish, and Arlene said, come and be a visiting artist and join our graduate class. You'll get a lot out of it and they'll get a lot out of it. So there's no downside. So she came, and what I got to watch was the process of a truly curious person investigate a truly curious topic. So Gail went to the library. She went shopping. This was before the internet, where your first thing to look up is Google. That didn't happen. But because that didn't happen, some of the investigation that she did into eyewear was into patent the books, the journals, the records, where you could investigate who made the first hinge on a pair of eyeglasses and what did it look like. She also investigated what was happening in art, in the modern art world right then. And it was the Memphis design movement. So it was bold color. There was big shapes. There were things that probably weren't going to look great on the human head.
But, the '80s.
Right. Inspired by all of that, she came up with something truly marvelous. She wanted to learn how to use a watchmaker's lathe. And so she turned aluminum and anodized it and colored it and came up with a pair of eyeglasses. It was truly very different than anything anybody had ever seen. She wore those eyeglasses back to Europe when she went home, and she was seen on the street by somebody from the eyewear industry who said, "Where did you get those?" She said, "I made them." He said, "I'll buy them." And the next thing I knew, or she knew, she was making a lot of money as an eyewear designer. And that was something that was not lost on me either. The thing that was not lost on me was that as an artist, you could earn a living, and it could be a fascinating way to do so. So at a certain point, I had taught for a while in metalsmithing. I had worked in various different jobs, just trying to cobble together a living. I got an opportunity to teach in Italy and work in an artist's home in Portugal for almost a year. And it all came together in a really magical and marvelous way. And it was because I had really started to investigate one topic, and that was eyewear. Instead of thinking I could make anything in the world got focused. It got focused on what I wanted to investigate. And I got interested in it. And the more interested in it, the more broad I found that world, the more it opened up.
Right.
Yeah.
Isn't it funny? You think that by narrowing your focus, everything will be narrow, but it's just the reverse.
It is.
This whole new world opens up. When you turn over a rock, what do you expect to find?
I was camping week, and I turned over a lot of rocks.
Uh-huh.
And one of the rocks I picked up had an embedded piece of some sort of a dark iron colored circle embedded in it.
Huh.
And what happened with that rock? I have no idea. I'd never seen anything like it. And I've collected a lot of rocks. So when I pick up a rock, perhaps the reason I'm picking up that rock rather than just walking on is because I don't know what's going to be underneath it.
Uh-huh.
But what I hope is not underneath it is some crazy bug or something that I really don't want to see.
Right.
That's fair. That doesn't happen. Yeah.
The question I pose just as a matter of, you know, being curious, but I forgot your background as a geologist. So that brings a whole new meaning to looking at a rock. Up here in Lyle, I've been going on these walks in the morning, and I pick up one rock. And that's it. I won't, because there's lots of rock. Once you start to look, you go, "Oh, I want this one. I want this one. I want..." There's all this stuff you want to pick up. But I focus and say, you can only pick up one rock, so make it good. And then I carry that rock for the day, and I stare at it and look at it, examine its quality. Sometimes I got a winner. Sometimes I this rock here, I love this rock. This rock's amazing, but you'd have to hold it in your hand.
Is it one of those rocks that has gotten blown by the winds of the Columbia River Gorge so much that it's sort of sandblasted?
Yeah, all the rocks pretty much have been, but some are really pockmarked and some are not. So I don't know if those are more basalt-ish or basaltic, whatever the word is. But yeah, most of them are very rounded because at this section of the gorge, I assume these are Missoula flood rocks.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, these could have been quarried somewhere.
You're right.
Brought up, you know, for the road. And so, you know, at certain sections of the road, it's just dull gray rocks. Nothing to look at. But then there are certain sections of it that have all these treasures, green rocks, pink rocks, red rocks. I love the red rocks. These deep maroon. I don't know what I'm looking at. I'm just picking up rocks. But it's, for me, it's a reminder to just stay focused. Just pick up one rock, concentrate on the day. Because it's so easy to.
Talking though, if you find what you perceive to be, ooh, that rock might be better than the one I'm carrying. Do you allow yourself, or do you have rules? You stick to your rule. It's only one rock.
Only one rock.
Uh-huh.
Now I could pick up a rock. This happened the other day. It had never happened. I've been doing this for a couple months. I've probably got 50 or 60 rocks, little ones. But the other day I picked up a rock and I walked with it for a while and went, no. And I sat down.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't good enough.
Uh-huh.
And it's a question of shape or color or defect. Defects are really important. Mm-hmm. Is the defect interesting? That's why I picked up this black rock, because it had this cool little sort of crack or fissure in it. But then I discovered this bump on it, like a hip bone. All right? You can feel the bone of someone's hip.
Uh-huh.
But you can't see it.
Uh-huh.
And why did that? There must be something really hard inside this rock. Because because the rest of it's all round and round. You know, fairly tumbled by life. And you think about a rock and go, wow, time, yeah. 300 million years.
Right.
or 10 million years. I don't know, whenever it got spit up out of the earth in my life. So a little different perspective.
Right.
Anyway, that focus, I think, is so interesting. In our opening podcast, I talked with my apprentice Ali about a house. I was strolling through the streets of San Francisco and sketching. And the man who owned the house invited me in and gave me a tour of the house. And it was, there was nothing special about it, but he took me into the dining room, and in the back of the dining room was a door. And we went through the door and walked down into this wooden library that he had imported from France and stuck on the back of his house.
Oh,
that overlooked the Golden Gate Bridge. He was right near the Presidio. And I was like, what the hell? It's just amazing. So that little door opened up into this giant world, and I was, you know, pretty remarkable. So that's what curiosity means for me. It just opens up possibilities. But how do you get curious? I mean, no one pushed me to do anything like that. Go to work, make money. What was your upbringing like as far as curiosity goes?
I grew up in California. And I grew up my dad worked for Sandia Laboratories, actually a bomb factory in, 60s, 70s, 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom was a housewife, and it was just a very sort of three kids growing up in a small town in the middle of California. What was great about it is my dad loved boats. He built himself a little sailboat, and so we learned how to sail. He bought himself a little bit bigger boat, so we learned how to scrub the barnacles off the bottom and fix the engine and camp overnight, camp for 3 weeks. We did all sorts of things, and all of our adventures usually were directed by some passion of my dad's. My mom went along with anything my dad said to do. It was pretty, it was nice. It was a good childhood. My mom taught me to garden, to cook, and to be interested in those things, not to just like, we have to do this, but to actually like grow those tomatoes and learn to make really good sauce. And make really good things that sauce went over, and to freeze those things and to can those things. And it was an industrial childhood, really. Even we did for fun, there was a bit of work involved in it. And I think that just growing up in that way, where I was comfortable enough to be curious about anything I wanted, I was the first person in my family that I really knew of who was obsessed with reading. I've always loved libraries. We had a library within bicycle distance of my house. So I spent a lot of time in that library. And that was that's the getaway plan, right? When you're a kid and you want to do something that you want to learn something. So that was it for me. I also had curious people in the neighborhood. There was a guy two doors down, Mr. Hudson, and Mr. Hudson had invented, as he was interested in jewelry making, he had invented this small casting machine, and he hired my brother and I in the summer times to turn these small parts on a lathe for his little objects that he then sold. And for me, that was just great. I got to learn how an inventor invented things, but I got to be a part in it as well. And I got to be a part in that way that says, if you don't have this thing, you can make it. And that's important.
Right. So. Yeah, not everyone has that skill, but also imagination at their fingertips to say, oh yeah, I could, how do I do this?
Right.
And so many people just say, oh, can't do that. And they walk away from the problem. But can people become curious? I wonder, I'm curious about them. What do you think?
Oh, I think absolutely.
A lot of people come from backgrounds where curiosity is not encouraged. You're not encouraged to go to the library or the museum, or, you know, I'm speaking for myself. You know, it was polka music on Sundays. That was culture, and the church. And that was, you know, that's pretty much it. So are you fortunate? Were you fortunate? How do people who come from backgrounds that they're struggling in, how do they become curious?
I believe a lot in chance meetings of humans that are interesting to some, for some reason. I mean, I feel very, very fortunate to have taken, education's always been really important to me. I'm interested in learning stuff, and I've been introduced to incredible people because they were a teacher, or they were a teacher of somebody else that I got to know, and they know this, and so you can learn that. If you want to go investigate, you go figure that out. So I feel super fortunate that way, that I have stumbled my way. My brother and I tease each other who's having the most Forrest Gump moment of time, where, you know, you find yourself sitting next to someone and that all of a sudden your life, you know, has just changed. The conversation that you have with them that makes them, because of something that they're curious about, and then you become curious about that as well.
So it's infectious?
Oh, don't you think? Yes, I do.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see it. Yeah, when I got out of college, I wasn't interested in anything. But I had a different background, and I needed to figure out how to change my world, because I was in the world of academia, and I was going to go get a master's degree and then probably a PhD. My brother got a PhD. My sister got a master's degree. I'm not smart enough. So, no, I'm kidding. But it was, in my world, it was just that, academia or get a job. And then I met, at my college, I met these physics majors, and they changed my thinking about what was possible. So yeah, it is infectious. I'd never thought about it in that way. Yeah, meeting someone whose curiosity leads you to go, ooh, never done that. You mentioned to me once that tools, discovering new tools, made you go after certain things.
Oh, don't you have tool lust? I remember meeting this guy who was making stainless steel bird cages.
Oh, wow.
I wanted to see how he was doing that. And he was using a pulse arc welder.
Oh.
Where you put the two pieces of metal together, put it in this jig that holds it together, and send electricity through it, and it welds it. And when I saw him operate that, that became like, I want one of those. And you know what I found on Craigslist? I found a pulse arc welder that was used by an orthodontist. And so he was using it on a micro scale. I bought that. I went through a lot of metal. I hurt myself a few times.
Shocked. Yeah. Yeah.
I learned a lot of stuff. Interesting. And I learned, you know, a way to do a thing. So yeah, absolutely. Tools send you into a new and different realm of curiosity. In photography, there's always a new tool. There's always the latest camera. There's always the new thing that's happening. And, you know, the great thing that happened in my lifetime, I think, was my ability to become very interested and intrigued and good at working with analog photography, you know, with film, with a camera. I had, when I was in graduate school, I studied with a guy who taught us how to use pinhole cameras. You know, we'd make a camera out of an oatmeal box. And so we learned how to create our own tools and create our own ability to see in a way that might be unique to ourselves. And I feel very lucky then in the next 20 years after those experiences to have digital cameras arrive. And then suddenly an iPhone can do more than some of the more sophisticated cameras that I ever had.
Oh, sure.
Watching all of that technology come through at such a rapid pace has been very inspiring to me. At times overwhelming and daunting. And there's times that I have said, all right, I'm done with that learning curve. I'm not interested in heading that direction anymore. I mean, how much can I take on? But I do have a wide attention span. There are a lot of things that are very, very intriguing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder about in the last 20 years, the tsunami of technology that's just kind of blown us over. It's hard to keep pace with it and not get sucked up in to some extent in one aspect or another. So I look around at all the computers I now have and never, ever thought I'd be in this spot. Yeah. It also has opened up possibilities that I hadn't seen.
Right.
Do you keep all your tools? Do you feel nostalgia for the ones you mean? I hang on to some things I know I'm never going to use, but I just can't get rid of them.
Yeah.
I can't.
I don't know if this is about, as long as I have room to put things in a place, I will keep it because I thought, like, I can see right in my rear view Zoom mirror an old dark room timer.
Right, I see it.
There's a scanner below that. There's a Rolodex to the side. Yeah. So if you had, which tool would you get rid of? The scanner, the Rolodex, or the dark room clock? I don't know. Any given day, it's going to be a different answer, but yeah.
Yeah, I know which one I'd get rid of. I'd get rid of the clock.
Yeah.
Because the Rolodex is history. I didn't have a Rolodex per se. I just had index cards and I found it recently when I moved my shop and I was like, oh, we have that person. And oh, I haven't talked to them. And it's just historical and it's fun. Like looking through old checkbook registers and going, oh, I remember buying that.
Right. That tool. That's right up there that I can't give away.
And I found a receipt for a tool that I had bought. I got to keep this. I forgot what tool it was. Right. But I know I shouldn't, but I do anthropomorphize some of my favorite tools.
Right.
And talk to them. Ah, well, there, I admitted it. So our title for this podcast is Creativity Hustlers, Fakers, and Thieves. You had a response to that title. Do you remember? Remember the note you wrote me?
Oh, that's sort of vague. Mostly that I'm weary of hustlers and thieves in modern society. They seem to be plentiful in a way that's not pleasing to me. I was going to say that I'd prefer authenticity. And
I think I'm going to just throw this out there that our technology has allowed us to be these. It's like intellectual property doesn't exist anymore. You know, everyone, we're sharing. I'm going to take your idea and share it with the world. Won't that be great? Sometimes it is, and sometimes it's really not. Yeah. And that's the part of thievery that can be disturbing to me. If you had to choose one, how would you describe yourself? Now, let me just permit me to broaden our definition of what these terms might mean, because you can be a hustler and not be a thief. You can just be hustling to, you know, get some stuff done.
Yeah.
You can, you know, anyway, that's the only qualifier.
I mean, as a self-employed artist has to be a hustler.
Yeah. But thievery is so, I mean, don't you think it's common? It's not necessarily evil. It's just, you get your eyes are open and you see someone making eyewear and you say, oh, well, I never thought of that. And this would be fun.
I don't think of that as thievery. I think of that as inspiration. You're doing this really interesting thing. I wonder what my take would be on that interesting thing.
Right.
And right. I think that there is such a, like, photography right now is so overwhelmed with, I mean, anybody can make a picture with any number of objects and within arm's distance without even thinking about it, with no thinking, you know, and they can have a good eye or not, or it makes the effort that goes into photography education, I don't even know where to go with that. I mean, I can get really bugged.
Go ahead. Because I think the fact that everyone has such access to photography means that it's gotten much worse. That we're just flooded now with bad photos or fake photos or, you know, photos that are cobbled together, and it's difficult to tell what's real.
Huh. Difficult to tell what's real. What's real mean?
Ah, interesting. Well, we used to use photography in a manner to demonstrate a moment in time. And now we use it, I think, to demonstrate our ability to edit, rather than seeing, you know, the daguerreotype of, you know, 12 people standing in front of a saloon. Now we have images created by, you know, pulling one image and stitching it together with another. So there's that level of verisimilitude. Now, clearly, every time I take a photograph out here in the country of a great sky or clouds, it's never the same as what I'm really seeing. It's really hard to capture that. And so I don't know that any of our photographs are real in that respect. There's always that, not just the lens, but the image itself it separates us from reality. Well, I don't know if that answered your question. What is real?
Well,
you know, that's a question that a lot of philosophers have struggled with. What is real?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you, what is real then in photography?
I've studied a lot of historical photography because I was always interested in the tools that went along with making photographs. From pinhole cameras to very sophisticated things. One of the most real photographs I ever witnessed was, there was a photographer, and darn if his name has escaped me, Jerry Spagnoli, maybe, something like that. He's a modern photographer who makes daguerreotypes. So it's a super slow process, and you have to be prepared. You have to have the emulsion on the prepared piece of metal, and it has to be in a dark place, and it has to be ready to be used if you're going to have any kind of spontaneity. On September 11th, he was in New York City, and he looked out his window and realized what was happening, and plate prepared.
Oh, wow.
He made a daguerreotype of that moment of hitting one of the towers. And it's, I mean, that to me, if we're talking about real. There's so much involved in that moment of making that extraordinary photograph.
Sure.
Of course, it's not an object that you can make over and over and over. It's a one-time thing. It's a daguerreotype. It is a very amazing piece of metal with a very piece of very amazing emulsion now that has that moment, that piece of reality trapped in it forever.
Right.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Yeah.
That's where it becomes a moment in time. And I guess my point is that nowadays it's that had such a measurable effect on so many people. But the photographs we, you know, you see on Instagram or, you know, the videos and stuff on TikTok, it's just more water just inundating us and doesn't make us stop and say, oh, this is an important point in time.
Yeah.
Now all time is important, which renders it unimportant to me. Every image is important. Take a picture. And then what becomes important about an endless? I mean, when I started out with my new iPhone, I just entered the digital age with my iPhone less than a year ago. And already I'm buried by photos.
Yeah.
I think that's perhaps my lack of discipline. I don't know. Yeah. Yeah, pretty interesting. I know that, you know, when the digital revolution, I had an event at the studio one time and this guy was sitting up on the steps and I said, so what do you do? And he goes, well, I used to run Y East Photo.
Ah.
Like, oh. Which was a photo studio in Portland that,
yeah,
did my film. You know, I bring in, you know, for both of my first two books, I was taking all the photos and I'd take it there and get it developed. And then the world changed. That place had long gone.
Yeah.
So there's that. But yeah, it's so interesting to me. And there's a side of me that says, she has taken craft and thrown it out the window by taking these scanning photographs. Yeah, and where's the tool here? It's a computer. And then I say, well, these are really cool images. I mean, I first saw your large-scale photographs at the Portland Airport. I was walking in that, you know, byway between the two terminals. And I saw, oh, look at these cool images. And I walked up and I saw, that's a Deb Stoner. I go, that's no way that's Deb Stoner's work. So it was amazing. And it was amazing to see. The fact that it came from a scanner, I think everyone has a line with technology. You don't seem to have a line with technology. I have a line in my studio about technology, over which I will not pass.
Sure.
You don't seem to have that.
The reason I started using a flatbed scanner as a camera is pretty simple. I was trying to investigate tintypes. I wanted to make still life photographs of flowers and print them on metal.
Uh-huh.
And make jewelry from it. So I was still a jeweler.
Right.
And I was looking to take my interest in photography and my interest in jewelry and put them together.
Right.
And it was right at that point when I was teaching at the Oregon College of Art and Craft, and it's great policy, which all teachers should always have, which is teach a class, take a class. So I was learning how to do digital photography. Uh-huh. And they also had a great dark room where I could learn how to make tintype. So, you know, we had 100 years of difference in the two technologies that I was trying to learn sort of simultaneously.
Right.
My teacher said, you know, you don't really have to learn how to make tintypes if you just want to print pictures on metal. There are surface bureaus who can treat your images. If you get the image that you want, they can print it on metal. So maybe you don't have to work with ether and cyanide and all these that maybe I didn't really want to work with.
Yeah.
Oh, well, all right. Well, how would you do this? He goes, well, for one thing, you need to make a digital negative. So he was going to teach me how to make a digital negative.
Huh.
Easiest way to make a digital image negative at that time was to take a photograph with a camera, create a digital negative from that. And that then could be used to print on the metal.
Uh-huh.
I'm leaving out a few chapters here. But anyway,
right.
The day that he said, all right, let me show you how to make this digital negative in the very, very simplest way. He grabbed an old dead flower. He puts it on a flatbed scanner. He pushes the button. And then he went through the workflow to create a digital negative from that. And all of a sudden, these lights went off. It didn't have anything to do with what was this tool. It didn't have anything to do with what was I trying to do with it. I just felt this sudden sort of veer into somewhere else. That's wow, I have a garden. I want to take pictures like this.
Right.
There was a very specific lighting that the scanner offered that was super different than any other kind of lighting that I saw, that I've seen. It had to do with light and shadow. And I thought, this is fascinating. This is what I want to do. And so I ended up, I would drive to school and I would show up with armloads of flowers. And then I would make these compositions on the scanner. And I could tell very quickly if it was a good composition or a bad composition.
Huh.
I mean, just remember all the time that you spent taking those photographs for your books, you know, and you'd have to take it then to White Yeast and wait for a week until it was developed. And you'd have to have had bracketed, and it cost you just armloads of money to do all the stuff.
Oh yeah, it was really expensive.
These large scale, 8.5 by 11 digital negatives that were all of a sudden, if it didn't turn out, delete, get rid of it. So it accelerated my curiosity in a way that I had never experienced before. And my ability to work with the flowers in a way that I just really wanted to see. I mean, another thing that was happening was my eyesight was starting to not be as good as it used to be. So I couldn't really see anything unless I had big, giant magnifying glasses all the time. But working large scale with a scanner that meant that the Xenia had all these incredible parts now could suddenly be blown up, and I could see that there were actually aphids in my Xenia, and I could see all the parts of the flower. That was an extraordinary experience. And so there was no turning back at that moment where nah, I'm not going to go get a normal camera and try to figure this out, because this one does something really different. And so, yeah, I spent a lot of time figuring that out. Right. The other thing that was interesting was that what I didn't understand about the scanner, some of the techs at Epson who built the scanners didn't understand it either. Like when I saw these red, green, and blue stripes across the scan, RGB, red, green, blue. What are those? Turned out, if you have a little live bug walking along as the scanner is moving along, the light from the scanner picks up and it's going at different rates. And so you can get these trails of RGB. Who knew?
Bug trails.
Yeah, I thought my scanner was broken. In fact, I thought, and Epson did too. They said, ship it back. We'll send you a new one. So they sent me a new one. I had the same problem. They said, what's going on?
Wow.
But finally, one day I saw it. It's an ant. That's what's going on. So that was interesting.
So you have to make sure that the bugs are dead, or do you?
The bugs are dead. Yeah.
Can you do time lapse so that you can see their trail?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people are doing really fascinating things with scanner because of that. You're working with something that's moving. And so still life is really the ideal subject.
Right.
Things are less than ideal.
Yeah. Right. I can see that. Well, that's fascinating how that opened up for you. Serendipity, but also a willingness to be open, I think, makes a big difference. Or a willingness to say, oh, I could maybe do something with this. I mean, you didn't know where it was going to lead you to.
No. How has that opened up in your life? Have you had experiences where you just made this complete U-turn because of some serendipitous, curious either person or thing or event that happened in your life?
That's difficult to assess. Mm-hmm. I met Leroy Setzel some years ago. And did you know him or his work?
I know his work. I'm in awe of it. And his daughter teaches at Sitka.
Yeah.
And I've been signed up for her class a couple of times, but things have precluded me from taking it. But one of these days,
Well, I particularly like the stuff I saw at a Portland Art Museum show about, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, which were tall pieces, not wall pieces. They were standing sculptures. And I thought, that's pretty interesting stuff. I'd like to try and do something like that. So I've been playing around. I mean, I've been playing around with that kind of shaping wood for a long time, but always with some sort of purpose in mind. Because purpose meant dollars, which meant I could eat. I've always been, limited by that and never. Yeah, the last 20 years, that's all I've been doing. Although it was to a good end because I sold my building, which is just the saddest thing. It really is just the saddest thing. But it's what I planned. I said, this is my retirement, and I did it. And so it's really good and sad, both at the same time. My meeting with Roy was less than ideal. Marty Widman and I, Marty and I went out there on a Sunday morning. She said, oh, just show up. It'll be great. And we showed up and Roy was like,
he didn't surprise visitors, please.
Didn't actually growl, but you could sort of see it. And he lived, and maybe his daughter still lives there, on a hill. I think it was in Sheridan. And it was just super precipitous. It was like, okay, if you want to walk around the mountain, you can stay at one level. Otherwise, you're going up or down. And the house was up high, and then I walked down to a shop. And he wouldn't give us a tour. He just said, go, look, I got my Sunday paper. I think his wife took us down there, and we looked around. So I Yeah, he wasn't the most hospitable guy on a Sunday morning, but it was fun nevertheless. And I understood it was no big deal. I didn't feel slighted, but it was interesting to see a space. And so many years later now going, oh, okay, that's what this is about. Oh. I can see what he's doing here. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, there's a tool technique there. It's interesting to see how his technique is, or his output is influenced by his technique, just like you. You know, what's the tool that he grabs to create this volcano-like shape in the middle of a panel? And I can see it, and now I can read that and understand it. Yeah. So that's kind of fun.
Yeah.
Well, this is great. I think anything else you want to add? So you never answered. Are you a hustler, a faker, or a thief?
I'm not a faker. I'm really wary of anything that smacks of fakery. Not interested in that.
Right.
And thievery, I'm also not interested in that.
I get it.
But I'm a hustler. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think you have to be, as you say, if you're going to be an artist, self-employed.
Yeah.
Got to hustle.
Yeah.
And it's I don't care what craft. I mean, you just have to hustle and it doesn't end. And
But another thing is luck. I feel more, I have been very lucky. You saw that exhibition at the Portland airport because of luck. I had some pictures that were getting a little bit of notice. And I was at a New Year's Day party and I met with a friend and my friend said, you should have a show at the airport. I'm like, yeah. How do you get a show at the airport? That's kind of like a dream. I said, no, I know the curator. You should call her. So I did. Yeah. I called her and she said, the photography area has, it's about a 2-year waiting list, and I have probably enough people for about 20 years. So, anyway, couple of days later, she called back and she said, could you do it this year? I said, yeah. And she said, well, the people who were going to do it have sort of not been very good at following through. So if you can get it together, you can have the show. So I got together. There is the hustling part.
Sure.
Got the hustle. I got the show. It was up for a year in the Concourse Connector. So it was a long, long hallway.
A lot of people saw it.
When it was over with that year, the next person in line didn't want to use the frames that they provided. And I said, my photographs are already in those frames. What are you going to do with those frames? Are you just going to put them in a closet or use them for hopefully the person after the next year is going to use them? He said, no. I said, you should keep my work in those frames and you should keep my work. May I donate them to the poor? And it took me about a year to convince them. They said, we don't want to own an art collection. It's like, you're the airport. You already own a lot of work. So there was a little hustle involved in that.
But finally,
they said yes. And then throughout their entire renovation, I would hear from people. I would get emails from people saying, I saw you work at the airport. I'm like, well, what gate is it at now? So anytime they would need work to beautify a new space
that's great.
Changing. And so over the past like 5 years, I'll get at least an email a week out of curiosity about my work.
That's great.
The ones that are my very favorites are the ones that somebody has written on their phone at 3 a.m. They're weary. They just want to get home, but my work has stopped them in their tracks.
They
take the time to look.
That's great.
They want to take the time to breathe. They want to take the time to write me an email and say how much they love the work.
That's great. That's
satisfying.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really nice.
Yeah.
I want to show you something in there.
Is it a feeder or?
Yeah, there's some rocks.
Okay. I see bird feeders. I see bungee cords.
Yeah, I got the bungee cords to keep the birds from flying into the windows. It doesn't always work. Now you can't see them. There's about 6 or 7 wild turkeys out there. Well, great.
They're like,
They're wild?
Yeah, they're wild turkeys.
Uh-huh.
They're big. They're big birds. And I go out there in the morning. This morning, there were about 6 or 7 wild turkeys and 6 or 7 deer.
Uh-huh.
And they're all just sort of milling around each other. And there was no water in the basins. So I said, all right, hang on, boys and girls, I'm coming out. And I came out. I'm 5 feet away from a deer.
Wow.
Because they're thirsty. So are the wild turkeys. And the wild turkeys are just, they're goofballs. I saw one fly yesterday. Uh-huh. I mean, fly. He flew across the yard and into the trees 20 feet up because there was the neighbor's dog is a poodle, dumb as a post, but, poodles are hunters. So
that bird knew.
Yeah. The bird was like, okay. And it separated, but I counted it again today. So they got back together. It's pretty fun. All right, here we go. Deb, thank you so much for this conversation.
You're welcome.
This was great fun. I really appreciate your time. And to let folks know, we've been here for an hour plus, and I'm going to take some snippets and put it onto our creativity podcast and some of the other stuff I'm going to use as well. And we'll be able to access it through our website, creativity-hft.com. Anyway, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for inviting me, Gary. It was my pleasure.
Good fun. Fun to talk about this stuff.